Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Chav Zayin Amud Aleph, three lines down. Doresh Bar Kapara, Mai Dichtiv. What's meant by the pasuk Vayisrof et Beit Hashem? So Minyan et Diyoma, the destruction, the korban of the Bayit, the korban of Yerushalayim. It says over there they burnt the Beit Hashem, Ved Beit Hamelech, Ved Kol Batei Yerushalayim, Ved Kol Beit Gadol Saraf Beish. So that's the pasuk, and now the Gemara is going to go through each item in the pasuk. Beit Hashem is obviously Zeh Beit HaMikdash. That references to Beit HaMikdash. Beit HaMelech, Elu Palterin Nishel Melech. Those are the royal palaces. Beit Kol Batei Yerushalayim Kemashma'an is the Pashtut, means the houses of Yerushalayim. Beit Kol Beit Gadol Saraf Be'esh. What is the meaning of that? What is that referencing? So Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi. Here we have a machloket, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi. Chad amar makom shemegadlim bo Torah. The word gadol, in a place where they elevate Torah, v'chad amar makom shemegadlim bo tefillah. So man damar Torah, dichtiv Hashem chafet zeman tzidko, yagdil Torah v'yadir. So here you can see that the word hagdalah, gadol, is associated with Torah. So therefore, Beit Gadol could be referencing a Beit Torah. Mandamar Tfilah, the one who says that it's referencing a Makom Tfilah, Dichtiv, Saprana, Hagdolot, Asher Asa Elisha. So they tell over the great things that Elisha had done. Ve'Elisha Davad Berachmei, Hu Davad. And when Elisha performed all of his miracles, all his great things, it was through Tfilah. So you see the word gadol is also used in association with tefillah. So the two options here are that Beit Gadol is either a Beit Knesset, a Makom tefillah, or it's a Beit Midrash, it's a Makom Torah. This goes back to what we left off with yesterday, which is, which has a greater Kedusha, a Beit Knesset, or a Beit Midrash. So you have exactly this machloket here between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shua ben Levi. Tistayim, Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi, Hu Damar, Makom Shemgadlim Bo Torah. Let us assume that the author of the opinion that says that it Beit Midrash is the highest level is authored by Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi. Damar Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi, Beit HaKnesset Mutar Lasoto Beit Midrash. Because one can elevate the Beit Knesset up to a Beit Midrash. Shema Minah, that he sees Beit Midrash as being the highest level. And if that's the case, then when we talk about Beit Gadol here, that is talking about the Beit Midrash, the place that is considered to be of the highest form of Kiddusha. And that again, based on the Machloket that we saw yesterday, as to which goes first, here you have Machloket Rabbi Shua ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan. Tosfot here is pointing out, we paskin like Rabbi Shua ben Levi, because the Beit Midrash is the one that has the highest form of Kiddusha, although Tosfot in other places takes issue with the conclusion that he's making over here. But the truth is that we do paskin that way. The Beit Midrash has the highest level of Kedusha versus a Beit Knesset, which would be a lower form of Kedusha. And the conclusion from that would be that a Beit Knesset can be elevated to a Beit Midrash, but vice versa would not be permitted. Correct. That is, we find in the Gemara and in other places that the Beit Knesset and the Beit Midrash were separate places. Today we still have that, where there are some places that are designated as a Beit Midrash and some places that are designated as a Beit Knesset. We do have, the Gemara tells us that it's person should daven in a place where they learn. That there is a maila to davening in the Beit Midrash, in the place that you do learn. So there is that association. I mean, they did daven in the Beit Midrash. Not that it was exclusively a Beit Midrash. No, but they learned there and they also davened there. Whereas a Beit Knesset, its primary function, its primary use is for davening in. All right, now the Gemara continues. Amachru Torah v'yichus Sfarim. Someone who sells a Sefer Torah cannot buy Sfarim with that. Ibayuhu. Ma'olim kor Sefer Torah yashan l'kach bo chadash. Can you sell an older Sefer Torah to buy a newer Sefer Torah? Why? Kevin delo malilei asur. Maybe because you're not elevating the Kedusha, then it's asur. Odilma kevin deleke le'aluyei iluya Acharina Shapir Dami. Since there is no level above a Sefer Torah, maybe it is permissible to do such a thing. Tashma. So let us try to prove it from our Mishnah. Aval Machru Torah Loichu Sfarim. Someone who sells a Torah should not with that buy Sfarim. Sfarim Hudulo. You can't buy Sfarim, meaning the Vimik Tuvim. HaTorah b'Torah Shapir Dami. But if you exchange the Torah for Torah, that would be permissible. Mar says, Matnitin di Avad. Our Mishnah is b'di'avad. Kigamai Mailan lechatchila. We want to know what the a priori answer is. Okay, our Mishnah is talking about once he's already sold it, what can he do with the proceeds after he has sold it? That's only because he took the action to sell it up front. Had he not sold it yet, and he comes to ask what he should do, then what's the din? Tashma. Golin Sefer Torah b'mitbechot chumashim. You can wrap up a Sefer Torah with the covers of chumashim. B'chumashim b'mitbechot nevi'im. And chumashim can be wrapped up with the covers of a nevi'im ektuvim. Avalo nevi'im ektuvim b'mitbechot chumashim. But the reverse is not true. You cannot put the cover on the nevi'im ektuvim that belongs to the chumashim. V'chumashimim b'mitbechot Sefer Torah. You can't take the cover of the Sefer Torah and place it on top of the, or place it to cover the chumashim. Now chumashim are basically a Sefer Torah, but they're just one of the chumashim, one of the five chumashim. So it's made the same way, and the same kedusha of its Sefer Torah, but it doesn't attain the level of kedusha of the Sefer Torah, because mipnei kvod tzibur, we only read from a Sefer Torah that has all the five chumashim in it. But otherwise, it does have the same level as the Sefer Torah, but one step below it because of that reason. So chumashim are the individual chumashim, just written similar to a Sefer Torah. So the Gemara says, from that you can conclude, or you could draw, to try to draw a parallel or inference from this, Daktani miat golim Sefer Torah b'mitbechot chumashim. Allowed to wrap up a Sefer Torah with the covers of a chumash. Mitbechot chumashim in. The wrappings of a chumash, yes. Mitbechot Sefer Torah, lo. But a cover of another Sefer Torah you cannot put on the Sefer Torah. It says, Ema Seifa. Well, that's an interesting diuk because you had it both ways. You could, the other Seifa says, Velo Chumashim, not Chumashim, but Mitbechot Sefer Torah. The Chumashim, you can't use the covers of Sefer Torah. Hat B'Torah B'Torah Shapir Dami. But if it was a Torah alone, it would be okay. Elamaha Lekalem Mishma Mina. From that Braita, we can't learn anything because the diuk would go in both ways. It's a little surprising because our Mishnah has the same setup. The Gemara over here assumes that our Mishnah indicates a certain way, but our Mishnah goes in the same way. It tells you what you can be Ummaaleh B'Kodesh to, and it tells you what you can't be Morid. So you should be able to be Medayek in both directions, yet the Gemara here is only Medayek in one direction from our Mishnah, which is that HaTorah B'Torah Shapir Dami, and then the Gemara just answers Matnitan Di'avad, that our Mishnah is only B'Di'avad. It's not telling you what the Iker Halacha is, Lechat Chila, which is what the Gemara is after over here. The basic question is, are you allowed to sell a Sefer Torah, period? Once you've sold the Sefer Torah, the Gemara seems to indicate that once you've sold the Sefer Torah, then b'di'avad, you have to use it to purchase another Sefer Torah. That's what our Mishnah is indicating. But if you didn't sell it yet, and you want to come to sell the Sefer Torah, you're asking us, can you sell the Sefer Torah? The Gemara at this point doesn't know. Are you allowed to sell it, or are you not allowed to sell it? And that's what the Gemara is searching for, the answer to that question. All right, Tashma. Another attempt to find an answer to this. Menichim Sefer Torah al gabei Torah. V'Torah al gabei Chumashim, v'Chumashim al gabei Nevi'im Ktuvim. You can stack up one Sefer Torah on top of another Sefer Torah. You can put a Sefer Torah on top of Chumashim, and you can put Chumashim on top of Nevi'im Ktuvim. Aval, and not the opposite way. Lo Nevi'im Ktuvim al gabei Chumashim. You can't place Nevi'im Ktuvim on top of Chumashim, lo Chumashim al gabei Torah. Not a chumash on top of the Torah. So there you have a clear indication, the fact that you can put one Sefer Torah on top of another Sefer Torah, which seems to draw the equation of equivalence between different Sefer Torah, which would say that you could sell one Sefer Torah to buy another Sefer Torah, because as long as you're staying on that level, on that peer group, it would be fine. That's what this Braita seems to indicate. So the Gemara says, no, that's not the case, because when you're talking about here, hanacha kamart, talking about placing on top of it, shani hanacha delefshar, placing on top of another item is impossible. De'ilo temahoche, if you don't say this, michrach heche karchinan, how do we roll up the Sifrei Torah? V'hakayiv dapa achavrei. When, by definition, when you wrap up or roll up a Sefer Torah, one page goes on top of the other page. And so, since it's kevin delefshar, since it's impossible to do it otherwise, shari, then it would be mutar. Achanami, so to over here, came into the Efshar, so there's no other way to store these items, then it's Shari, it's Mutar. So here they're talking about, or seems to be, one of two instances, either in the Aron HaKodesh, that they didn't have the Aron HaKodesh the way that we have them, where we stand them up, or they are vertical, but rather they were lying down. And since it was lying down, the only way to store them is on top, one on top of the other. So since there's no other option, then we permit it. But here, when you're talking about selling, there is another option. Don't sell it, and then we won't have to buy another Sefer Torah with it. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that they actually took the Sfarim out. And when they took the Sfarim out, they have to put them on the Bima, they have to lay them down somewhere. So you're allowed, for instance, on a day that you took out three Sefer Torah, you're allowed to stack one Sefer Torah on top of the other one, and then read from them as you want or as necessary. I mean, today we solve that problem by having someone hold the Sefer Torah, so that we don't stack them on one on top of the other. But in an instance where it would be impossible, you would be permitted to put one on top of the other. So the Gemara rejects this as a proof to our situation, because the Gemara says this is a unique situation in terms of stacking them on each other because of the necessity to stack them on each other, and also from the fact that, by definition, when you roll something, it stacks on top of itself. So we have to permit hanacha, we have to permit the placement of one object on top of another object. Now, this does have nafkaminot in terms of placing Sfarim on top of each other. What's interesting over here is that the Taz describes in Yoredeya, in the discussion of these halachot, he brings down that it's important when a person's learning not to use Sfarim in a manner which is beneath the dignity of the Sefer. So for instance, if you want to read a Sefer and you need to raise it up or you want to lift it up, you should not place it on top of another Sefer, because then you're using that other Sefer like a block or like a piece of wood. He says that's a bizoy, it's a denigration of the other Sefer. So using it as a prop or a way to hold up the other Sefer for you to read, that is impermissible. He says if you happen to be learning a Sefer, and then you open up another Sefer, you can place it on top of the Sefer that you're learning, because that's normal, in the normal course of learning. That is something that you're doing. You're not using the other Sefer to prop up the Sefer. It's just because you need more, multiple Sfarim open. Therefore, you're allowed to place them one on top of the other in order to facilitate the ability to read one or the other. He says you shouldn't use a Sefer for a bookmark. That if you have to mark off a page, you shouldn't stick another Sefer into the Sefer that you're reading in order to keep the place. Unless, again, you're learning the other Sefer and happens to be open. So again, in the course of learning, that is permissible to have Sfarim stacked on top of each other or intertwined with each other, but to simply use a Sefer in a way of an object, like a bookmark or a prop, that is not permitted according to the Taz, and you have to be careful about that with regards to Sfarim. The Aruch HaShulchan wants to suggest over here that these dinim of hierarchy only apply to items that have Kedushat Sefer Torah, Kedushat Chumashim, Kedushat Nevim Ktuvim. On the other hand, Sfarim, printed Sfarim, and items like that do not have that type of hierarchy in placement on one on top of the other, and therefore a printed Chumash is no different than a printed Navi and Ktuvim, because the printed Chumash does not attain the higher level of Kedusha that is associated with a Sefer Torah, so therefore you don't have this hierarchy between a Sefer Torah and Navi and Ktuvim. They'll all be on the same level, and you can put them one on top of the other if necessary, like we suggest over here. So that's the way that the Aruch HaShulchan says. He makes that distinction based on the Rashi here. It's Midayek. This all has to do with Sfarim and Kedushat Sfarim, but with printings where you don't have that distinction, it would not apply necessarily. People in general are Makpid when they stack up items, that they try to put them similar to what our Gemara is describing over here in a certain type of hierarchy with Chumash on top, and then maybe Nevi'im Ktuvim afterwards, and then our Mishnah, then Gemara, then other Sifrei Halakha. They try in general to put them on top of each other in some sort of order, as long as it's practical and it works that way. Sometimes it's very impractical. But we try to give a certain amount of respect towards these Sfarim, in both in when we stack them up as well as when we utilize them, that they maintain a certain semblance of the Kedusha and the importance of what they are, and they're not just simply books that we throw around like we would with secular books. All right, so now the Gemara says, Tashma. Let's try to bring a proof from this. Dama Rabba Bar Chana, Rabbi Yochanan, Mishim Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Lo yimkor adam Sefer Torah yashan, likach bo chadash. You're not allowed to sell an old Sefer Torah to buy a new one. Gemara says, Hata Mishum Pshuta. That's similar to the problem by the Shul that we saw yesterday in the Divrei Rav Chista. is we don't allow you to sell a shul to build a new shul, because the fear is that once you've sold the old shul, you may not come around and build the new shul. So you can say the same thing over here. If you sell an old Sefer Torah, we're not going to let you do that to buy the new Sefer Torah, because you may never come around to buying a Sefer Torah, and then we've lost the ability to have a Sefer Torah. But in a case where you already have it in place, King Amrinan, Gon Dichtiv Umanach Lufruke Mai. In a case where it's already written, and it's just sitting there, and it's just a question of paying for it. In that case, can you sell the Sefer Torah or not sell the Sefer Torah? So we agree to preempt and sell the old Sefer to buy the new one, that you cannot do. But once the new one is ready, and it's simply a matter of exchanging, meaning selling the old one and buying the new one immediately, what's the case there? What's the halacha then? So Tashma. Tam Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Meir, Ein Mochrin Sefer Torah, Ela Lilmod Torah V'lisa Isha. There are only two things that are permissible in terms of selling a Sefer Torah. One is to sell it in order to learn Torah, and the other one is to marry, or to use the proceeds in order to marry. So Shma Mina, Torah B'Torah Shapir Dami. The Gemara says, well, now you can see that there's an equation. Gemara is now thinking that learning of Torah is the equivalent of a Sefer Torah. So you can sell a Sefer Torah in order to facilitate learning Torah. So that means you can sell a Sefer Torah to buy another Sefer Torah. Gemara says, Dilma Shani Limud. Who says that's the case? Maybe learning Torah is very different. Shadimud mivi lidei ma'aseh. Learning Torah is even on a higher level because it brings a person to action. Meaning that person needs to learn Torah in order to do the mitzvot and to practice as a Jew properly. So maybe limud Torah does take precedence over just owning the Sefer Torah. But a Sefer Torah is a Sefer Torah. We can't learn anything out. Isha nami. With regards to a woman, the same thing is true because of loto vira'a l'shevet yitzarah. Shem didn't create the world to go desolate. He expects people to procreate, to fill in the world, to make it a populated world. And this is a fundamental mitzvah. That's what the Gemara is pointing out over here. We've discussed this in other places, that here the Gemara seems to indicate that there is fundamental mitzvah of lo tovu v'ra'a, independent of pru or vu. And the question is, how do those two mitzvot interact? Are they separate mitzvot, or is pru or vu simply an enhancement of lo tovu v'ra'a? But you see over here, the Gemara assigns to it a very high importance, this idea of lo tovu v'ra'a, that it becomes such a fundamental precept that we are willing to sell a Sefer Torah in order to carry out that precept, which is that one should populate the world. Ava Torah b'Torah, lo. But it comes to one Torah to another Torah, maybe it would not be permissible. But since these two mitzvot are unique and so important, that's why we allow you to sell a Sefer Torah. But other mitzvot, including buying another Sefer Torah, maybe we would not permit. Over here, the Gilyon HaShas points out that Tosafot in Baba Batra says that it also is permitted for Pidyon Shivuin. When it comes to redeeming captives, that one can sell a Sefer Torah, and he says the Gemara doesn't list it here because it's Bipshitut. It's simple. The Gemara says it's obvious that you can sell a Sefer Torah to do Pidyon Shivuin. According to the Rishonim, other Rishonim, it's not so obvious. Some say that you can't do it. Others say you can only do it as a last resort. Some say you can only do it if it's a private Sefer Torah, not if it's a public Sefer Torah. But Tosafot at least entertains that possibility that Pinyon Shivuyin would also be included in the sale of a Sefer Torah. Whether you can sell a Sefer Torah for other items, we're going to see in a second, because we have this next statement, which is, Tanra Banan, Lo Yimkor Adam Sefer Torah, Afo Pishen Tzarich Lo. A person may not sell a Sefer Torah, even if he no longer needs it, in that he has another one, or for whatever reason, it's not necessary to keep the Sefer Torah. Okay, now Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, afino ain lo ma yochal. If a person doesn't have what to eat, umachar sefer Torah, and he sells the sefer Torah, obito, or he sells his daughter, meaning his daughter as an ama ivriya, ino re siman bracha deolam. Person will never see a blessing from that sale, from the monetary proceeds that he receives from the sale of that sefer Torah, or from the sale of his daughter. So over here you see that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel takes a strong stance against selling a sefer Torah for personal benefit. From Ris, the Rambam paskins that a person, even if they have nothing to eat and they have no food, they cannot allow to sell a Sefer Torah in order to get food, in order to provide for oneself. That Gaud Mamoniot and some of the others after them, including the Beit Yosef, mentioned maybe that's not true. All that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says is over here is that you're not going to see a Siman Bracha. He doesn't preclude you from doing it. You can do it. You just won't see a Siman Bracha. And therefore they disagree with the Rambam and say you can sell it in order to feed yourself, in order to have money to eat. Just, it won't come to a siman bracha. I mean, it's a necessity. So if it's a necessity, you can do it. That's generally the way that we pass with regards to selling a Sefer Torah. Over here, the Gemara does not have a conclusion. Tried numerous times to come to a conclusion, and the Gemara did not conclude. Based on that, the Rif says that we go L'chumra. Since the Gemara never concluded about which way to go, the Rif, and the Ron quotes this, says that the Rif says then, since there's no conclusion, we must say L'chumra, and we won't allow you to sell a Sefer Torah in order to buy a new Sefer Torah. And so, we pask in L'chumra that one may not sell a Sefer Torah in order to buy another Sefer Torah. Now, in terms of exceptions to that rule, where are there exceptions when you can sell a Sefer Torah? Number one, in a case where it might be a private Sefer Torah, in a case of a private Sefer Torah, you might have the right to sell it versus a public Sefer Torah where you wouldn't have that permission. And number two is a Sefer Torah that's pasul. Then you may sell a Sefer Torah that's pasul in order to buy money or raise money to buy a kosher Sefer Torah. So that's one exception to the case where you have a pasul Sefer Torah. You can sell it in order to raise the money to get a kosher Sefer Torah. So that's one exception to the rule. Number two is where you have a tnai that's built into it. When the Torah was bought originally or paid for originally, there was a tnai built into it that it would be permissible to sell the Sefer Torah. That would be permissible, or if someone's transacting, he buys and sells Sefer Torah, that would be permissible as long as that was his intent originally and there's a tnai built into doing such. So that's another dispensation or possibility of selling the Sefer Torah. And the other possibility, as we just mentioned now, is if it's owned by a private individual versus a public. But there, the Shulchan Aruch brings down two opinions as to whether a private individual can sell a Sefer Torah or not sell a Sefer Torah. The Magen Avraham paskins that you can't sell it because even when the Yachid gives it to the Tzibur to use, he gives it on condition that he maintains his right in the Sefer Torah that he can sell the Sefer Torah. And the reason maybe an individual can sell the Sefer Torah is because he might not be different than what we call Shiv'a Tuvei Ha'ir and the Mamad Anshei Ha'ir. So when you have a public item, in order to sell a public item, you must go ahead and get permission of the leaders of the community as well as the people of the community. And if it's a private individual, he basically has the same status as the leaders of the community and the public at large because it's his Sefer Torah. So he's able to generate the sale or do what otherwise could be done by the Mamad Anshei Ha'ir as well as the Tuvei Ha'ir in selling an object. So that's with regards to a Sefer Torah. With regards to the first statement of the Gemara that our Mishnah is talking about a case Bidiavad, that's also subject to a Machloket Rishonim as to whether when we say it's Bidiavad, that's only by a Sefer Torah or that's also by other items in the Mishnah. When the Gemara says it's Bidiavad, that means that everything in the Mishnah, you're not allowed to sell. If you happen to sell it, then you have to be maled b'kedusha. But we don't allow you to upfront sell it. That's one possibility of reading it, the way the Gemara says. Or, is the statement of the Gemara bidiavad only about a Sefer Torah? Because Sefer Torah has a unique standing, which is there's nothing above it to buy. So that since there you cannot be maled b'kedusha, there we say it's bidiavad. If you sold it, then we allow you to buy another Sefer Torah. But otherwise, we're going to tell you, please don't sell the Sefer Torah. That's a question amongst the Rishonim as to whether when the Gemara made the statement of Bidiavad, is that only true about a Sefer Torah because of its unique standing as being the top level of Kedusha? Or does that apply to everything that is found in our Mishnah that we discourage you from selling these items? But Bidiavad, if you did sell them, then we allow you to deal with it by being Malebi Kedusha, raising the level of Kedusha and buying something that is a higher level of Kedusha. And as we discussed yesterday, in terms of selling items, where it's done, Bimamad, Zayin Tuvei Ha'ir and the Mamad Anshei Ha'ir, there we saw the Machloket Rishonim as to what that does for you. According to Rashi, that clears everything up. That means that the item itself, like the Beit Knesset, loses its Kedusha as well as the monies that were transferred afterwards. Other Rishonim believe that that only helps you to get rid of the Kedusha on the item that you're selling, but the monies retain the Kedusha. And still others think that it's very hard to get rid of the Kedusha at all. Unless it was done out tonight. It was done with the condition built into it originally. Right now, the Gemara continues with what the mission says, the leftovers from the monies. If you sold an object and you had leftover money, you purchased something of a higher kedusha, but now you have leftover proceeds. The Mishnah says, with those leftover proceeds, you still have to use them to elevate kedusha. That's only true if they sold it and now there's leftovers. Aval gavuvel tiru, if they collected monies for a specific purpose and now they have excess, mutar, then you can change what you use it for. And you can, since they never attained the level of Kedusha, even though they were collected for a specific item, since they never themselves attained that Kedusha, the excess can be used for other items. It does not have to be solely used for the item that it was collected for. It's only if they didn't make a condition in it. If they made a condition, you can even use it for a duchsusia. All right, we'll see what that means in a second. Hechidami, what's the case here? If they sold it and they had excess, if they made a condition, why does that help you? Because what does the condition have to do? You're selling the item. Once you sold the item, the condition has no ability to change the leftover proceeds that you have. It must be a case where they collected money and they had excess. It's only because they made a condition in the collection that said that if they had excess, they can use it for whatever they need. If they didn't make a condition, then you couldn't use it for what you pleased. So that's against what Rava just said. Mar says, no, the olam shemachru ve'otiru. No, it was a case where they sold it and they left over. It's only in a case where it wasn't sold with the permission of the leaders of the city as well as the public. You sold it, then you can do whatever you want with the proceeds afterwards. Tosafot over here asks a very simple question. He says, okay, but that's not unique to the motarot. That's not unique to the leftover money. That's true of the core money itself. Once you have the permission of the leaders of the city as well as the people of the city, then you can do whatever you please with this money, not even just the leftover money. So Tosafot says, why is the Gemara focused on the motarot? So Tosfot suggests over here, "Afilu b'chol damim yochlim hin lasot mashiyotzu." Yesh lomar denakav otiru l'ashmin and afim motar bayitnai. The chiddush of the Gemara here is that even in the excess, you need the permission of the leaders as well as the anshei ayir in order for it to lose its kedusha. You would have thought maybe you only need that permission when you're dealing with a core item and you're able to use the proceeds and buy something that was of higher kedusha. Then you need the permission of the individuals, but the leftover money, maybe that would automatically lose its kedusha. Along comes the Gemara and says, no, it does not lose its kedusha unless you qualify with the Tuvei Ayir and Mamad Anshei Ayir. And again, then once you have that, you're allowed to use it for what you please, which is a duchsusia. So what's a duchsusia? So Amalei Abai Lahavu Mir Rabbanan Dahave Misader Matnita Kameder Rav Sheshet. Abai asked one of these individuals who used to learn before Rav Sheshet, Mishmi Alecha Mir Rav Sheshet My Duchsusia. Did you ever hear from Rav Sheshet what this Duchsusia is? So Amalei Achi Amar Rav Sheshet. It's Parsha Demato. Is the horse of the city. It's the cavalry of the city, which Rashi tells us is a messenger. So there is a messenger on call for the city. So you're allowed to use the proceeds, the excess proceeds, to pay for such a messenger to be available. So again, even though it's not a davar shibik dusha, once you've gotten the permission of the elders of the city, the leaders of the city, as well as the people of the city, then once it's sold, it doesn't have any dusha, and you can spend it as you please, including getting a messenger for the city. So Rabbi Yilka chayt sumri b'rabbonon d'shamalei milta v'lo yada perusha. Person who, a young Talmud Chacham, that hears something, he doesn't know the definition of it, he doesn't know what it means, or he doesn't understand it. Like here, Abai didn't know what Duchsusia was. Then, Lishaile Kameh Deshchia Kameh De Rabbanan. He should ask the question of someone who is regularly in front of the Rabbanan. Dohevshar Delo Shmiele Min Gavra Rabot. There's no way he didn't hear an explanation from such a great individual. That's exactly what Abai did. He asked someone who was always in front of Rav Sheshet. He asked him the question, and then he knew it because he was in front of Rav Sheshet, so he must have heard something like this, and he explained what this Duchsusia is. The Gemara started out with Rava saying that with regards to the Motarot, that's only true when you have leftovers from a sale. But if you have leftovers from a collection, then you can do with it as you please. The Bayu tried to suggest that's only if you had a Tanai based in it. The Gemara rejects it and says, no, the Tanai is based on the selling of an object. And the selling object, you need the Tanai, as Tosfot points out, even to cover the motorot, even to cover the leftover monies, even though you've used the other monies to buy something of a higher level of Kedusha, the leftover monies also, to lose their Kedusha, need the leaders of the community, as well as the community as a whole, to agree to the sale in order to remove the Kedusha from the item. Okay, Rabba Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishur Rabbi Meir, B'nei Ayir Shalchu L'Ir Acheret, U'Pasku L'Hem Tzedakah. They go to another city, and then they are asked to donate to a cause. That either, the way Rashi says it, it seems that they volunteered to give the tzedakah. And so in order to make it not look like they were saying that they were going to give the tzedakah and they didn't give it, so they give the tzedakah. Others suggest is that the city enforced it upon them. The whole city gave. So these people were in this other city and they enforced upon them to give tzedakah so that it won't be a chashad that they were skipping out of giving tzedakah. So here they gave it. Ukshein ba'in, when they leave the city, ba'in mevino ta'imahen. They take the money with them. Umfranasim ba'aniya yiran. They can bring it back to their own city in order to fund whatever projects or tzedakah that they need in their own city. So because they're present in this city, now whether, again, they voluntarily said they were going to join into the tzedakah drive, or whether everybody there, it was imposed upon everybody there, in order to avoid chshad, that people will think that they're not paying up, or that they're not joining in, they have to pay in. But then we say when they leave the city, they can take the monies with them, because they only paid in because of chashad. They didn't pay in because they really were going to give tzedakah here. They plan on using that tzedakah, or they'd rather use that tzedakah in their own city. So what they do is they go to the gabbai tzedakah and say, please refund us our money so we can take it home with us in order to use in our own city. So that's what Rabbi Yochanan says, that a large number of people from a city that are in another city, if they give tzedakah, they can demand of the gabbai to give them the tzedakah back when they leave, to take it back to use for their own city. Tanya Nami Yochi, we have a brayta that supports that. Bnei Ha'ir shalchu le'ir acher to pasku le'em tzedakah notnin. They give, ukshein ba'in, when they leave to go home, they bring it with them. On the other hand, an individual who goes to another city, he gives the money and it stays with the gabbai tzedakah and is used in that city. So here you see a distinction between an individual who's in another city and then gives money into the tzedakah drive, whether he voluntarily offered to give it or they imposed it upon him. That money stays in the city because he doesn't have clout to take the money back with him. He's an individual, so he becomes subsumed in the city, and the money will go to the aniyim of that city. And then when you're dealing with a large number of people from another city, or the entirety of another city, over there we don't say, just leave the money here. We say, take the money back, otherwise they're going to have nothing to support their city with. They won't have money available to take care of the aniyim in their city. So when they leave, they can take the tzedakah that they gave and take it back to their city. Rav Huna Gazar Tanita, Huna established that there would be a tanit. Alagabei Rav Chana Bar Chanilai v'chol b'nei mate. So with the tanit, they gather together in the main city, the main area with Rav Huna. So Rav Chana Bar Chanilai came along with all the members of his city to join in the fast day and to join into the tefillah of Rav Huna. So Rama Alai would tzedakah. Again, they imposed upon them to give tzedakah. I mean, everybody would give tzedakah as part of the tanit, and we know that one of the zchuyot, or the main zchut of a tanit, is the tzedakah that is given. And they gave it. When they wanted to go home, give us the money back. We're going to take it to use it for the aniyim of our city. Tanina, he says, you know, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to give it to you, Rav Huna says, because tanina, we have a tanaic work that says, when is it true that you can walk off with the money and take it back to your own city? Shein sham chavir. If there's no Talmud Chacham here that takes care of all the tzarchei tzibur. Aviyesh sham chavir, tinaten lechavir. If there is a Talmud Chacham who's considered to be the main individual who deals with these issues and is entrusted with these issues, then you can't take the money back. He says, clearly, the aniyim of my city, as well as the aniyim of your city, come to me. I'm the main person who distributes tzedakah. And even the people from your city come to me when they need tzedakah. So since that's the case, I'm not going to refund you the money because, in a sense, I'm responsible for this city as well as your city as well. And since that's the case, there's no reason to give you the money to take it back to your city, since my position allows me to take care of this city as well as your city. So your city's not going to lose out by the fact that I have the money, since my scope in terms of leadership extends beyond my city, but even to your city. And since that's the case, I'm not going to refund you the money, and your aniyim can come to me to get the money, as they do always. They always come to me anyway to get money, and so therefore I'm not going to refund you the money to take it back home with you. Okay, next Mishnah. Ein mochrim et shel rabim liyachid. You can't sell a shul of the rabim to become a shul of an individual. Mipnei shemuridim oto mikdushato, divrei Rabbi Meir. Because you are now taking it down a notch in Kedusha. The way that they explain it is because you're dropping the Kedusha from a tzibur, which would be a minyan, down to a yachid, which wouldn't necessarily have a minyan there. Amrulo, imkeim naflo miyir gdola liyir ktana. If you're going to say that, then you should also not be able to sell a shul or an object from a large city to a smaller city. It says, Shapir Kamalei Rabbanon the Rabbi Meir. The Rabbanon have a good claim against Rabbi Meir. If you're going to say you can't sell from the Tzibur to the Yachid, you should also not be able to sell from a large city to a smaller city. Rabbi Meir, Mi'ir Gdola Dir Ktana, Mikara Kadisha, Hashtana Mikadisha. Originally it has Kedusha, meaning the Kedusha of the Tzibur, and now it still has a Kedusha of the Tzibur. So therefore there's no problem in doing that. On the other hand, Mi Rabbin the Yachid, like a Kedusha. On the other hand, when you drop from a tzibur down to yachid, you're dropping down from a dvar v'shebik dusha of 10 people down to an individual who's not necessarily going to have a minion there. But it's a shul or it's an object of kedusha. Rabbanon, iikal mechash ki hagafno nami iikal mechash. If you're already going to worry about moving from a tzibur down to a yachid, you can also worry about moving from an ir gdola to an ir ktana mishum rova am hadrat melech. There is an enhancement in being in a greater and a bigger city. Not only is there a tzibur and dvar v'shebik dusha, Davar Shibakdusha can be elevated another stage, which is Berovam Hadrat Melech. When you have more people, there's more honor to the king. There's more honor to the king, then that's a higher level of Kedusha. Since a higher level of Kedusha, if you're going to go from a big city to a smaller city, you're dropping down. You lose Berovam Hadrat Melech. So if you're going to say that it's a problem moving from Tzibur to Yachid, it also should be a problem from moving from a large city to a smaller city. And we don't think either of those are problematic. And that's why we disagree with you, Rabbi Meir. Okay, next Mishnah. Ein mochrim beit knesset el al tanai. Shem yirtzu yachziru div Rabbi Meir. So we have another statement of Rabbi Meir. Here Rabbi Meir is machmir. First of all, you may not sell from a rabbim to yachid. The second thing he says here is if you sell a shul, it's on the condition that they can reverse the sale if they so choose. So I mean that it's basically built in there that they have a right to buy it back. Div Rabbi Meir. Chomim amim mochrim oto memkar olam. You can sell it a permanent sale. Rabbi Meir says it's a improper, it's a denigration of the shul. It's not appropriate to sell it permanently. So you have to leave this window to be able to buy it back. In other words, Chachamim say you can sell it like any other object and sell it permanently. Chutz mi'arba dvarim. There are four things that you may not sell it for. The merchatz, to be used as a bathhouse. The burski, to be used as a area for working the hides, to tan the hides. Litvila, a place where they use it for washing or going to the mikvin, or the beit amayim, which Rashi brings down two interpretations. One is the kvisa, it's a laundering place. The other one is the beit mei raglaim, which seems to make more sense here, which is to be used as an outhouse or a privy. Ayud omer, mochrim oto l'shem chatzer. Here it says, no problem, just sell it generically for a courtyard. Okay, achmashi yitzeh, yes it. Once the buyer buys it, he can do as he pleases with the place. I mean, you're not selling it specifically for that reason. You're just selling it generically. Once he buys it, he can then decide what to do with it, and then it's not a problem. That's Rabbi Yehuda's position. So now, in terms of, here we have another layer of halacha with selling a shul, which is according to the Chachamim over here, you may sell a shul, but you may not sell it if the location is going to be used for something that is not of proper kavod, or really is beneath the dignity of the shul. So now, based on that, we actually have three gemarot really associated with this issue of selling the shul, or four gemarot here. We have here the Mishnah, which says the Chachamim say you can't sell it for these items that are not appropriate for a makom of the shul, even though once you sell the shul, the kedusha is gone. Still, this is inappropriate. We had the Gemara yesterday, which says that when it comes to selling a shul, if it's done b'mamad, the anshei yir, as well as the permission of shiva tuvei yir, then you can even do it, afilu the mishta be shichra. You can even use, here it's a question to be shown in, whether that means you can use the monies to buy beer with it, or according to the gears of the Bach, you can use the makom of the shul to set it up as a pub and to dry fruits there. And then we have the next statement, which was that Ravina had this tila, the beik nishta, and went to Ravashi, and he wanted to know if he could plant it, and Ravashi says, you gotta go buy it from the Shiva to Veir, as well as the Maman and Sheyair, in order to utilize it. That's another statement. And then we have our Mishnah. as well as the Gemara about the motorot, the leftovers. So in order to reconcile those, you have to come up with a shita in how you can sell a shul and what happens when you sell a shul. Rashi says, again, Rashi says this back on Chav Vav Amud Aleph, that if you do it b'mamad anshei ayir and the shiva tuvei ayir, the monies don't have kedusha and the shul itself does not have kedusha anymore, and you can do as you please with either item. On the other hand, it's not done with the shiva tuvei ayir and the mamad anshei ayir, then the money retains its kedusha and so does the Beit Knesset retain its kedusha. So Rashi says that it's an either or, meaning that it's a binary. Either you can get rid of the kedusha both from the makom as well as the monies, versus a case where if you don't do that, you can't get rid of either of the kedushot. So that's the way Rashi learns it. The Rabbi Kiv Eger already asks on Rashi, and this Mishnah is obviously problematic for Rashi, because what's the case here in this Mishnah? Did they do it tuvei ayir and mamad anshei ayir, or they didn't do it? And according to Rashi, if they did it with the proper way, then why is it a problem what they use it for? If they didn't do it, according to Rashi, the Kedusha remains, and then you can't use it for any item. Forget about for these items that are denigrating. So because of that, many of the Rishonim take a different approach than Rashi to with this issue of selling the shul, or removing the Kedusha of a Beit Knesset. One approach, like the Ramban, as an approach where you don't need to sell the shul with the Shiva Tuvayir and the Mamad Anshei Ayir, but if you do that, then the monies retain their Kedusha. And the selling of the shul works, and it transfers the kedusha from the makom onto the monies. But if you want to use the money for something else, or if you want the money to lose that kedusha, then you need to do it be mamad anshei ayir as well as with shiva tuvei ayir. That's one possibility. The Ran has an interesting approach to this. So the Ran says that it's actually there are two stages in all of these items. There's a stage in which you can move the kedusha from the place onto the money. And there's a second stage where you can move the kedusha off of the monies itself. It says that the sale itself already gets rid of the kedusha from the makom onto the money. And then removing the kedusha from the money itself is done by selling it through the shiva tuvei ayir as well as the mamad anshei ayir.
And that can be accomplished because of the fact that once the kedusha is transferred onto the money, it has a lower form of kedusha. And since that's a lower form of kedusha, the shiva tuvei ayir together with mamad anshei ayir can remove that kedusha.
The other approach that is promoted by the Rambam and the Rosh,
that once you sell the shul, the kedusha transfers over to the money. Now, once you get permission of zayin tuvei ayir as well as mamad anshei ayir, actually two things happen. The first thing that happens is that the kedusha is removed from the money itself. In addition to that, you now have permission to use the makom of the Beit Knesset, not only for items like you were before, but even for davar bazui. You can even use it for the four items that are mentioned in our Mishnah that the Chachamim say you cannot use it. So the tuvei ayir and mamad anshei ayir take it from simply being a transference of kedusha from the Beit Knesset onto the money. Now they remove the kedusha for the money, but in addition to that, they take away any semblance of remaining kedusha with regards to the Beit Knesset, and that gives you now permission to do whatever you want with it. And that's what was happening with Ravina. Ravina was doing a davar bazui, was planting it, and therefore once he got permission, as Ravashi says, from the Zayin Tuvei Ayir B'Amad Anshei Ayir, he could do that, he could plant it, because now there is no semblance or remnant of kedusha that is left there once you've done it in that manner.
Anyway, so that's just with regards to the shul. Now, the Gemara wants to understand the position of Rabbi Meir in our Mishnah. Isn't his position somewhat problematic? Not because of the issue of Kedusha, but a problem because of halachot of ribit, which is, Ulram Meir, hechi dariba. In the interim, how does the individual use the space? Havilah ribit. It becomes interest. Because basically what you've had here is that the buyer is now lending money to the individuals who sold the shul. Because effectively, they can come back and buy back the shul. So say in a year from now, they decide that they didn't want to sell it, and they come and buy it back. So what did he essentially do? He lent them money for a year, because they bought it back at the same price he sold it to them. But in the interim, the person who bought the shul lived there, or he did whatever he wanted with it. He did whatever he pleased with it. That possibility to utilize it without paying rent is a benefit to him. So now you have a benefit that he is garnering for the fact that he lent money to these individuals. So it's the equivalent of rebate. It's the equivalent of interest. So Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Meir, Vishita, Rabbi Yehuda Amra. Rabbi Meir is doing this within the position of Rabbi Yehuda. Damar tzad echad beribit mutar. That when you only have one-sided ribit or contingent interest, it is mutar. That is because if they never buy back the shul, if they never exercise the option to buy back the shul, then there's no ribit here. Because his living there is because he owns the area. He owns the space. But if they do exercise the option and buy it back, then there would be ribit because he's gaining a benefit in the interim and then he's getting his money back. So that's what we call tzad echad beribit. Only in one of the two possibilities or two outcomes will there be ribit. You have two possible outcomes. One of them will lead you to having interest. One will not have interest. Rabbi Yehuda in that case says tzad echad beribit is mutar. So as the Gemara suggests, that Rabbi Meir in this case must be holding like Rabbi Yehuda, the Tanya. Sharei sheye noshe b'chavireu mane, vasalo sadeo mecher. Person who is a creditor to his friend for 100 zuz, and he takes the debtor, gives him his field, and sells it to him in the interim. So he says, listen, take the field in the interim, and if I get the money, I'll buy the field back from you. Bizman shemucher ochel peirot mutar. If the seller, meaning the debtor, continues to eat the fruit, then it's fine. Lokeach, on the other hand, if the creditor who bought the field, ochel peirot, eats the peirot, asur, it's a problem of ribit. Because in the end, if the debtor comes up with the money and buys his field back, in the interim, the creditor ate the fruits from that field. Why did he eat the fruits? Because basically, he lent the money. So it's the equivalent of accumulating interest by the fact that you lent money to the debtor. Even if the buyer, meaning the creditor, is eating the peirot, mutar. Because, again, it's sadechad beribit. Because here, there's two possible outcomes here. Either the debtor comes up with the money, and he buys his field back. If he does that, then you do have a problem of ribit. But if he never comes up with the money, the sale is permanent. If the sale is permanent, then there is no ribit. That's ribit mitzad echad. And you see, Rabbi Yehuda is matir. Rabbi Yehuda maseh bebaitos ben zunin shasah sadeh umecher. He did exactly this. The debtor provided his field as payment until he could raise the cash or the monies. Al pi Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah velokeach ochel perotaya. In that instance, it was a case where the buyer, meaning the creditor, was eating perot in the interim. Samrulo, misham raya, you can't bring a proof in that case. Mocher ochel perot haya, you got the facts of the case wrong. It was the seller, meaning the debtor, who was eating the perot in the interim. Velo lokeach, and not the buyer, not the creditor. So my benayu, what's the nafkamina between the Tanakama, Chamim, and Rabbi Yehuda? Tzarechad beribit, ike benayu. That's the difference between them. Masavar tzarechad beribit mutar. Tzarechad beribit is mutar. Masavar tzarechad beribit is asur. So that's one way to explain the machloket over here between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim in our Mishnah, as well as the position of Rabbi Yehuda versus the Chachamim in the other Mishnah, which is it says tzad echad beribit. When you have one of two possible outcomes leading to interest, is that called ribit? Because it's not certain that you will get the interest. It's only contingent on the fact that he actually takes back or exercises the option. And if he exercises the option, there is ribit. If he doesn't, then there is no ribit. So Rabbi Yehuda says it's fine. Rabbi Meir here says it's fine. Chachamim say, no, that's problematic. That's one way to explain the machloket. Then, we have Rav Amar, Dukuli Amat Tzarechad Beribit Asur. In our Mishnah, everybody agrees that even with contingent interest, it's Asur. V'hacha ribit amanat ha'chziri k'minayu. It's a case where they collect the interest on condition that they'll return it if the deal falls apart, the option is exercised. So there, Marsever it's mutar, meaning that to do this is mutar. Marsever asur. That's a machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim and the Mishnah, as to whether they have an agreement that if they decide to reverse the sale of the shul, or they decide to undo the mecher, that they will give back. He'll refund the money, or they'll refund the fruits that he ate, or he'll refund the rent that he got in the interim. So therefore, it's not problematic. That's what Rabbi Meir says. The Chachamim say it's problematic because in the meantime, he's collecting the interest. Even if he refunds it later, it still looks like interest, and we're not going to allow you to do that. Tosfot over here does ask from the cases in Baba Metzia, it's really from the Gemara Zanezu Neshech, that you're not allowed to lend out an object in order to return that, for instance, a commodity, like wheat. You're not allowed to lend out a bundle of wheat or a sa'a of wheat in order to be repaid with another sa'a of wheat, because the price of the commodity might change in the interim, and it might turn out, even though he's giving you back the same commodity, the commodity might be worth more money when he returns it to you, and it'll be the equivalent of paying interest. So Tosafot says, why isn't that called tzad echad beribit also? Why don't we say the same thing over there? Because there it's only one of two possibilities. If the price of the commodity goes up, then it looks like ribit. If the price of the commodity goes down, it doesn't look like ribit then. So why do we say it's a problem? So Tosafot differentiates in the cases and says, it depends how you structure the transaction. In the case of Sa'av B'Sa'av, it's a loan through and through. He lent a Sa'av wheat, and he got repaid with a Sa'av wheat. So that's a loan. A loan, then Tzadacha, even Tzadacha B'Ribit, Rabbi Yehuda would agree, is problematic. In our case here, they structured it as a transaction. Since they structured it as a transaction, over there, Rabbi Yehuda is willing to say Tzadacha B'Ribit is Mutar. And that's what gives you the Heta over here, is because it was structured like a transaction and not like a loan. Even though in the end, it turns out to be like a loan, but since the whole deal is structured around being a sale, that's what permits you to have Tzadachat B'Ribit, according to Rabbi Yehuda. So the assumption is that currency is the fixed item, and everything else moves relative to the currency. That's especially true in their day, where the currencies were actually the metals themselves, the underlying metals themselves. Today, you might be correct that if you are in a foreign country, and then you transact, for instance, if you're in Israel, and you're transacting in dollars, that might be the equivalent of Sa'ab Sa'ab. That might actually be the equivalent, because the repayment of money might have relative value to the local currency. The assumption is that if you're working the local currency, then it's not a problem. If you lend in a certain amount, you can give it back in a certain amount, even though, quote-unquote, the currency itself changes relative to other objects. But we assume that the currency is fine, that that's not considered to be a problem. But you could be correct that if you're using it relative to another currency, meaning that the home currency is different than the one that you're lending in and repaying in, that there might be an issue there similar to what is being described over here. All right. Achamim omrim, mochrim oto memkar olam. You're allowed to sell it permanently. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, mutar la'adam lashtin mayim betoch dalet amot shel tefilah. Person is allowed to urinate within dalet amot of where he davened. Amar Rabbi Yosef, ma'ika mashlan. What's the big chiddush about your statement? Tanina, we already have that in a Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda omer, mochrim oto l'shum chatzer. Our Mishnah says you can sell it, according to Rabbi Yehuda, to be used as a chatzer, v'lokeach ma shiyirtzeh yaseh, and the buyer can do as he pleases with it. V'afilu rabbanan lo kamri ela beit knesset dekviya kedushatei. Chamimu disagree in our Mishnah, it's only because the beit knesset that was there had a fixed kedusha to it. Since it had a fixed kedusha to it, we don't allow you to use it for these items that are beneath the dignity of a beit knesset. You can't sell it to be an outhouse or to be a privy, because that's beneath the dignity of the beit knesset. That's only because it's a fixed kedusha. Aval, when it comes to dalet amot, to luk via kedusha tayu, when a person just davens out in the field or out on the street, nobody's going to suggest that his dalet amot makes the whole place kadosh now and that you can't urinate in that location. No, that would not be the case. Even the chachamim would agree there that you don't have to worry about using it for other purposes once you've davened there. So tani tana kameda Rav Nachman, amit palel marchik dalet amot, umashtin, a person who davens has to move away four amot and then urinate. But mashtin, and someone urinates, marchik dalet amot umit palel, has to distance himself from the urine and then daven. Hit four amot and then daven. So they say, bishlama hamashtin marchik dalet amot. I understand when you urinate that you have to distance yourself four amot umit palel, because it's improper to daven within the framework or the context of the urine. So tanina, that's a mishnah in brachot. Kama yachik mehem uminetzoah. How much you have to distance yourself from urine or excrement, dalet amot. Once you've distanced yourself from dalet amot, you're considered to be in a different area, and that's why you can daven. Ela mitpalel, once you've davened, marchik dalet amot, mashtin, lomali. Why, after you've davened, do you have to wait or move away for amot and then go urinate? Where it says, yihachi kashtinu lukule shvile denardo. Now you're going to have a situation in which now you're making every thoroughfare in Narda kadosh, because people daven, or they say here the wayfarers or the people who are traveling through, they have to daven. So they end up stopping on the side of the road, in the middle of the road, and they daven. So the fact that they daven makes the place kadosh, and now anytime somebody davens there, you're going to have to move away dalet amot. Where are you going to go to the bathroom anymore? There's going to be no place left. So Mara says, Tani Yishehet. No, what the mount here is not that you have to move a distance of four amot, it's that you have to tarry, you have to wait four amot, the amount of time it would take to walk four amot. So again, bishlama mashtin yishehek kedei hiluch dalet amot. A person who urinates, you have to wait the amount of time it would take to dalet amot, mishum nitzotzot, because of the drips, which would fall onto the clothing, which would be inappropriate. So we want you to finish completely the urination. We want you to wait a little time so that it's all cleared out. And then only then, we allow you to daven. Ela mitpalel yishehek kedei hiluch dalet amot. Why a person who's daven has to wait the amount of time he would walk for amot? Lamali, why do you have to wait that amount of time before you start urinating? So Amar Rav Ashi should call dalet amot filato stura b'fiv. Because even when a person finishes davening, for that amount of time that lingers afterwards for four amot, he is still talking in tefillah, he's still thinking about his tefillah, and his lips are still quivering. And that the tefillah doesn't leave him immediately. It's still a part of what he's saying. He's still thinking about things. He's still saying things. So he needs a little downtime. He needs a little tail off time before he goes to urinate so that he's clearly finished with his davening. So what you come out from here is that if a person urinates, there are actually two requirements. One requirement is that you move Dalet Amot away because you need to distance yourself from the urine. In addition to that, you have to wait the amount of time of Dalet Amot in order to daven, in order to make sure that all the nitzotzot are cleared out, all the drips are cleared out. So that's number one. The other way around, if a person davens, then there he doesn't have to distance himself for Amot because we just showed that there's no kedusha to the makom. But on the other hand, he does have to wait the amount of time of Dalet Amot after he's finished davening to make sure that he's really finished davening before he begins to urinate or do something that would not be appropriate while he is davening. All right, now we move on to a sugya that's going to last through way into tomorrow's daf, which is questions of Talmidim of the Rebbeim as to why Mameh Harachta Yamim. Why did you leave such a long life? And each of these individuals ascribes their long life to a certain practices that they had, practices that were special, unique to them, and that's what they thought gave them the zchut in order to have a long life. Shaul Talmidav et Rabbi Zakai, Bameh Harachta Yamim. What allowed you to live a long life? Samalhem, Miyamai, Lo Hishtanti Mayim B'Toch Dalamot Shel Tefillah. Obviously, this is connected to the previous Gemara. He says, because I never urinated within Dalet Amot of my tefillah. And as Tosfos points out, it's in a case, Afilo Heicha Sheyesh Heter Gamur. Even an instance where it would have been totally mutar, like he fulfilled all the conditions that we said before, nevertheless, he wouldn't urinate. He went Lifnim Mishurat Adin. So all these cases here, we have to ask that question, which is, if they're just keeping halacha, that's not going to give them harachat yamim. It has to be that they did something special or beyond halacha, beyond the letter of the law. So over here, he went beyond the letter of the law, even though he was permitted to urinate in this location, he would make sure to move away, and he described extra kedusha and was extra careful about this. Below kiniti shem lechaverai, I never called my friends by nicknames. Again, something that is not permissible for anybody. So there, as Tosfos points out, that a nickname is problematic when it is a denigrating to the individual, or it's pagamish pachad, based on their family, some problem within the family that it notes. So that's when it's problematic. On the other hand, if it's just simply a name that is given to the individual, which is might even be positive, over there, that would be permitted or would not be asur mi'alacha. So over here, he says, even in that instance, I didn't use that. I always called them by their name. I never called them by their nickname. Velo bitalti kiddush hayom. And I never gave up making kiddush ala yayin. And I was makpid to always make kiddush ala yayin. So imas kena haitali. I had an elder mother. Pamachat machra kippah shebirusha. She sold the covering on her head, or whether Rashi says it's saif, it's a scarf, or some sort of hair covering. Veviyali kiddush hayom. And she used the proceeds to buy wine so that I would have kiddush. Tana kishemeta. When she died, hinichulo gimel meot garbe yayin. She left him 300 barrels of wine. Ukshemeitu, hinich levanav, he left his children 3,000 garbe yayin, 3,000 barrels of wine. So because they were makpid to always do kiddush ala yayin, so therefore they were rewarded with plentiful wine. They were rewarded with the fact that they got lots of wine, because as Tosfos points out, we have in the Gemara, it says, Hazayir b'kiddush hayom zechem amalim lo garbe yayin. Person who's careful about kiddush hayom, meaning doing ala yayin, he will be rewarded with wine. So here you see that it's what happened. His mother was makpid to sell things in order to have, like the shirt off her back, in order to have wine for kiddush. So she had 300 barrels of wine when she passed away. He who continued that practice and multiplied even more and had 3,000 barrels of wine when he passed away. Rav Huna hava asar rita v'kai kamed rav. He was wearing this belt that was made out of, whether it was a reed or some sort of grass. I'm like, my high. He says, what is this belt? I mean, why aren't you wearing your regular belt? I'm like, lahavali kiddusha, or kiddusha dioma. I didn't have the wine for kiddush. Mashkante laham yanai. And I used my belt as collateral in order to get money. Vati be kiddush, and I bought wine for kiddush. I'm like, hey, Rava, titon bishirai, that you should hear a tzom from Hashem that you should be covered in silk, and that he gave him a bracha that he should be rewarded in with wealth and with all these wonderful things because he was sacrificing his own clothing, again the shirt off his back, the belt, in order to get kiddush hayom. Ki ichlal rabba brei. from like klilat yofi, which means to get married. So when Rabbi's son got married, this is the son of Rav Huna, Rabba bar Rav Huna. Rav Huna inish gutzahavo, he was a shorter man. Gana apuriayo, he was sleeping or laying down on the bed. Atin benate vikalate, along came his daughters and his daughters-in-law. Shalchan, they disrobed. Vishajin manayu ale, and they ended up throwing all of their garments onto the bed where he was sleeping. Adito mishirai, until he was covered in silk. So Rav's brocha came true. It came true that he was covered in silk in this instance. Shama Rav vikpit. Rav heard that his bracha came true and he got upset. Amar my time alo amartli ki brachticha v'chein lamar. When I gave you a bracha, why did you say v'chein lamar? And to you too also. Why did you also push, you know, reflect the bracha back to me? As Rashi points out over here, Shemaya itratzon. Maybe it was a time where Hashem was generous in giving out brachot. V'tikayim afbi. So if it was a good time, you should also have given me a bracha at the same time so that I should have received the bracha. Because Rav sees that his bracha came true. Since his bracha came true, it might have been an eighth ritzon, then why didn't Rav Huna say the same thing back to Rav? So Rav would have been a beneficiary as well. So here we see, again, proper etiquette is to, someone gives you a bracha, to respond or reciprocate with a bracha so that they should have the same benefit as you. That's proper etiquette. And then we also have the principle, the Gemara in Brachot says, Al tiyeh birkat ejot kala be'enecha, that even a simpleton's bracha is also has value to it. And therefore, you shouldn't say, oh, you know, he's a big Rav and I'm a little guy. No, that everybody's bracha has value, and therefore one should always reflect brachot back and forth. I agree with you. It doesn't prove that he was wealthy. It's just the circumstance in which all the silk ended up on top of him. I think you have to guess, you have to say that the Gemara felt that that was an indication that he had gained a certain amount of wealth because all of his daughters and daughter-in-laws were wearing silk. That indicated a certain amount of wealth that he had. Even though, again, you're right, in the incident itself, it doesn't prove anything. It's just the fact that they just threw their clothes on top of him, so he had silk on top of him. It doesn't prove anything. But I guess you have to make the next step, which is, why were they wearing silk? It must be because he had gained a certain amount of wealth. Okay, Shalu Tami David, Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua, Beme Arachta Yamim. What caused you to have long days, a lengthy life? Amalehem, miyamai lo asiti kapendria lebeit haKnesset. I didn't make the shul into a shortcut. Velo pasati al rosheam kodosh, and I did not walk on the heads of the people. Velo nasati kapi belo bracha, and I didn't duchen without making a bracha. Let's go through each one of them. Not making the shul into a kapendria. So this is it. He described again. Meikar Adin, you're not allowed to make a shortcut. You're not allowed to walk through a shul for no reason. But even if he had a reason to go in there, he wouldn't use the shul to cut or to make it a shorter way for him to get somewhere. And so he was makpid, even when it's mutar, or even when it's possibly he could have used it, he didn't use it in that case, and that was lefnim yishut adin, and that's why he says he was erachta yamim. Lo pasati am rosh amei kodesh, nobody would walk on people's heads. So as Rashi explains over here, it's because if he came in later to this year, then he would have to walk through all the people that were sitting on the floor, and it would look like he was stepping on their heads. So he would make sure to get there early, in order that it wouldn't look like he was stepping on their heads to get to the front, or they would carry him across so it wouldn't look that way. This goes back to the Gemara that we saw earlier about that the teacher and the students have to be on the same level, and we noted over there that there are many Gemaras, including this one, where the students are clearly sitting on the floor, and the Rebbe is not sitting on the floor. So we talked about it over there, how to reconcile this. But he didn't do that because he felt it was not proper kavod to the tzibur for him to do this. It's based on the Gemara in Sota and Daf Lamed Tet, that the Kohen, when they go up to Duchen, they make a bracha. Again, what's the big deal? Of course you make a bracha. It's a birkat a mitzvah. Every Kohen that goes up there to Duchen makes a bracha. So what was so unique about it? So the Karen Ora in the Gemara in Sota actually says that you would have had a Havamina that you don't have to make a bracha here because Birkat Kohanim itself is a bracha. So you would have thought that you don't have to make a Birkat a mitzvah because it's inherently a bracha. So that's where along comes Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua and his Mechadesh over here that, no, you still make a Birkat a mitzvah. And that's why he was makbid to make a Birkat a mitzvah, even though there's a possibility you shouldn't or didn't have to make a Birkat a mitzvah. And that's what was unique about him. That's our practice today, of course, that every Kohen makes a bracha when he goes up to Duchen. So his chiddush is the fact that they did have a bracha and there was a birkat mitzvah. You would have had assumption that maybe there should be no birkat mitzvah. For instance, like by Kiddush Levana. By Kiddush Levana, you don't have a birkat mitzvah and then do Kiddush Levana. You just do Kiddush Levana. by Birkat HaMazon, you don't have a Birkat HaMitzvah. The bracha is the mitzvah itself. So you would think the same thing by Birkat Kohanim. Since there's a bracha, there should be no Birkat HaMitzvah. So the Chiddush of Elazar ben Shammuel is that there is a Birkat HaMitzvah. And that's what the Gemara in Sota says. Okay, what is the bracha? And then they go on from that. But Rabbi Elazar ben Shammuel is the one who's Mechadish that there should be a Birkat HaMitzvah in this instance, even though maybe you would have thought otherwise. Alright, so, Shalu Tomei David Rabbi Preda B'mer Rachta Yamim. Why did you have a long life? Again, Tosfot raises over here that the Gemara in other places talks about the fact that through the zchut that he taught one Talmid 400 times until he understood it, then Hashem granted him a long life. So Tosfot over here says that he didn't realize that. He didn't understand that that was the reason, and here he's giving the reason that he thought he had a long life, which is B'mer Rachta Yamim Alehem. Nobody ever got into the Beit Midrash before me. I never made a bracha before the Kohen. Rashi over here says that it's done with Birkat HaMazon, that I never benched when there was a Kohen there. I gave the honor to the Kohen. And I never ate from an animal that didn't have the matnot kuna, the Zerah L'chaim, the kebab taken off of it. Not allowed to eat from an animal that doesn't have the matanot taken off of it. It's equivalent of tevel. I mean, it's equivalent of tevel, and you can't eat it. It's problematic. The late hilchata kavadei and aloha is not like him. Even though you're supposed to give the matanot kuna, it's only an issue of gzeilah there. It's not an issue of tevel. It does not posel or does not make the animal problematic in terms of eating it. Again, that comes up in the modern day era about how you deal with matanot kuna. And the Haramat HaMatanot, it's not so simple, and it's definitely an issue about how to deal with that. Again, it doesn't make it tevel. So when you eat it, it's not an issue of tevel. The problem is the gzela of the Kohanim, which is the issue here. It's not an issue of the fact that the food itself is asur, or the items are asur. It's a question of, it really belongs to the Kohen, and how do I deal with it? V'lo barachti lifnei Kohen, and I never benched before the Kohen. I mean, I always give the honor to him. L'memra d'mel yutohi. Sounds like that's a milo. Tamachachon gives up his right to bench first, and he gives up even to the Kohen Gadol. If he's an Amaretz, then that Tamachachon is Chayav Mita. Shnemar, Kol Misanai Ehavu Mavet. All those that hate me love death. Altigri Misanai, don't read it as being those that hate me, Ela Masni'ai, those that cause hatred to me. So as Rashi explains over here, meaning that here, when he allows the Am Haaretz to go before him, that makes other people look at this and say, look, there's no real honor to the Torah. Being a Talmid Chacham doesn't gain you anything. There's nothing good about being a Talmid Chacham. And then from that, there's a loss or denigration of Torah. You cause hatred towards Torah. When it says, Ki Gemar Ihu, when Rabbi Preda was talking about this, is Bishavim. That when they're on equal level, if they're on the same level, he always allowed the Kohen to go first. If it was a Kohen Am Haaretz, then he would take it first. But if he wasn't a Kohen Am Haaretz, it was a Talmid Chacham, then he would grant it to the Kohen. Tosfot asks over here, because there is a din of Kiddush Tov, that you grant the Kohen the first right by certain items. Tosfot discusses maybe it's by Aliyot to Torah, and afterwards he says he agrees with Rashi, we're talking about Birkat HaMazon. By Birkat HaMazon, we don't have this issue of fighting about who gets it. That was only established with regards to Aliyot, that the Kohen goes first. Who gets the first Aliyah? The Kohen, then the Levi, then the Israel, was to avoid fighting. On the other hand, by benching, we don't have that condition, although we still have the principle of Kiddush Tov, that any Davar Shebik Dusha, he gets the right to bench first. So Tosfot comes up with another Hechitimtze, it's a case where he's a Talmid Chacham, but he's not as great a Talmid Chacham as Rabbi Preda, and he still let the Kohen go first. So even though technically Rabbi Preda could have objected and gone first, because he was the top Talmid Chacham, nevertheless, he granted the right to the Kohen, and that was Lifnim Mishur Tadin. So since he acted in these ways, Lifnim Mishur Tadin, that you say, that's what he thinks granted him the ability to have a long life. Okay, we'll stop over here.